Going through the jasmine in my mind. Did you ever hear that song, Jasmine?
That was beautiful.
Yeah,
yes.
That is, yeah, I'm actually doing both the harmonies for Seals and Crofts on that. Yeah, that's Summer Breeze. When I was a little kid and that song first came out, you know, you never, a lot of times, you never saw the lyrics before. They never used to use the print lyrics anywhere. There was nowhere on the internet to look up lyrics.
Right.
And so I thought it was Jazz Bud, whatever that means. And I still don't even know what Jasmine means, but it sounds cool. But you knew that, right?
I knew that, but I don't know necessarily, like, if Jazz Bud is
Bud is a word, but if you listen to it, listen to the song the next time you hear it, and think Jazz Bud, and you'll go, it sounds like Jazz Bud. I was, what the heck? I was like 7. How do I know what Jasmine or Jazz Bud is? So,
yeah, right.
Anyway. So, and now I'm working with a Jasmine, so we'll see how long this lasts since I've been through about 15 producers in 15 months.
Don't say that.
Well, we'll see. Maybe you'll be here in 3 weeks. Maybe you won't.
I will be.
All right. Well, there you go. There's your challenge, the Elton Jim challenge. Will Jasmine be here in 2 or 3 weeks? We shall find out. Are you ready? This is your maiden voyage. Are you ready?
Of course.
All right. We shall see. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, another new episode is posted here at WGNplus.com. According to my sheet, episode 74. Then they said it wouldn't last past 72. So we've already beaten the odds. I'm Jim Toronto, and I appreciate you taking some time to click on or punch on or whatever the heck you do to find this at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, new episode on the website. And of course, don't forget, I have something called a landing page where all previous podcasts, so up to this point, all previous 73 should be up there for your listening pleasure. And you should be, you should do your homework, because there will be times, like today, in fact, when I do refer to past conversations that we've had. And so it does pay to be up to date on your Elton Jim Captain Podtastic podcast. I would say after the first 12, I considered myself binge worthy. So if you haven't listened to all 73 up to this point, consider me binge worthy, and find 73 hours sometime in your life to get caught up. So what I wanted to talk about today are a couple of things that I have spoken about in the past, which, interestingly, but not surprisingly, at least from my standpoint, have come to fruition. There are some times when I am Nostradamus and I am able to predict the future. And so it's been over a year on a few of these, or several months, where on this podcast, initially, I came out without any kind of previous knowledge of what might happen. The news just broke. But I put on my thinking cap, and I went into my crystal ball, and I said, here's what I think's going to happen with this, folks. And sure enough, I'm happy to say to some, well, I'm not happy, because both of these situations are kind of unfortunate. But in terms of me predicting what they would have been, I'm at least happy that my opinions and my my foresight and my radar were pretty close to be right on target. So I'd like to call today's segment here, you heard it here first, because I really believe that I was one of the few people to come out right at the beginning on these couple of topics to not only point out their flaws, but predict where things would be. And as we stand here now in October of 2017, as I said, they did come out pretty close to exactly what I had talked about. So, in Cook County, in Chicago, Illinois, you may recall, listeners of this podcast, several months ago, I explained how I've never been a pop drinker in my entire life. Never really drank a lot of pop. When I was growing up, I was never in the house that much. Remember my dad buying Hawaiian Punch, but we never really had pop a lot. And when I went by my friend's house, we had pop. When you went to a fast food place, certainly had pop. But I was never really in the house. I never really grew up with it and don't have an automatic taste for it. Always drank a lot of water even when I was a little kid. And some Kool-Aid and stuff like that. I mean, you know. And always a milk drinker. But pop was never really big in my house when I was a little kid. So, and even in the years since, I've never went out of my way to drink pop. And as by a fun circumstance, went out to a restaurant back in, I think it was February or March of this year. And there was, my wife likes root beer. And so there was this special root beer that was on the menu. It's called Sprecher's. I never heard of it. Apparently it's made in Milwaukee. It's very popular, beer and root beer. I never knew that. As I said, I'm not really into pop. So my wife says, oh, whoa, it's up on the board. It's written a special, Sprecher's root beer. Like, it's a big deal. Let me taste that. And then I looked on the menu, and they had other Sprecher's flavors. And I saw grape soda by Sprecher's. And I was like, boy, I remember having grape soda when I was a little kid. We'd go to, birthday parties, and they would have grape soda and cream soda and every soda because the parents didn't know what kids liked, so they bought one of everything. And back then, grape soda was pretty popular. So I remember I always liked grape soda. And even Kool-Aid. I used to like the grape Kool-Aid, that bad, whatever that powder was. It's kind of scary. But I used to like the grape. And there, in fact, there was called Funny Face. There used to be a Kool-Aid drink called Funny Face that came in a package, and they had different characters, and my favorite character and flavor was Goofy Grape, which really explains quite a bit now into the present time. But anyway, not a big pop drinker. I taste this Sprecher's grape, and I am in ecstasy. Oh my gosh, I now have found my new favorite beverage. And so, like I do with so many other things, once I find something I like, I go way overboard on it. And so I found out that I could buy Sprecher's at Menards. So I went to Menards, and I just bought these four packs, these four bottles, 16-ounce bottles and four packs of Sprecher's grape, and I tried some other flavors, and I just stacked them up along the basement floor of my house, and I wanted to make sure that I had enough Sprecher's. And I'm all excited that now I've got this favorite drink, and after not being into soda pop for most of my life, I now found that I like the soda pop. And then literally within a couple of months, I pick up the newspaper, and Cook County decides to impose a pop tax, an extra penny for every ounce of pop. Well, these Sprecher's bottles are 16 ounces, so 16 times 4, holy smokes. I'm spending like 64 cents extra. Now, I had bought a lot, but I certainly was going to run out at some time. And I just looked and saw through this tax for what it was right at the beginning. This was a money grab. There's no doubt about it. Other cities in the country had imposed this tax, and they found it to be a fairly good revenue generator. Cook County is notoriously in debt. And the Cook County Board President, Tony Preckwinkle, saw a very quick way on a regressive tax, which just takes money right out of people's pockets based on what they like. And it was a money grab. They tried to shield it, and they tried to pass it off like it was a health kind of thing that we're going to help. By raising the tax, people would drink less pop, and it would be better for them. But think about the logic of that. The idea was to raise money. But then you're saying people will stop drinking pop. So then they won't be drinking as much. They won't be buying as much, so you won't raise as much money. So what are you talking about? You're either taxing us to raise money or you're trying to find a way to worry about our health. If you're going to do that, then why don't you start a program that helps us or those who are addicted to pop? But don't shield it like it's some kind of we're doing you a good. This was a money grab. It was a revenue generator. And I called for at the beginning, I said, this is wrong. You call this for what it is. It's a money grab. And I was saying, and to me, you know, obviously, you know, things like cigarettes, you know, tobacco and alcohol have high taxes. The whole idea of that is they're called vice taxes. And, okay, if people want to do it, they do it. But, you know, pop is a different thing. Pop is something that adults drink and kids drink, whether that's good or bad. It's a recreational drink. It's not some kind of vice like alcohol or tobacco. And I predicted that people were going to be upset about this because people just have pop in their refrigerators. And you could drink pop and not be an addict with it. You can drink pop in moderation. And so I actually started out as a joke because I was saying, hey, you know, I finally get into drinking pop and now they impose this tax. And I kind of made a joke on it that I was going to, and actually another radio station in town stole my idea. I was joking that I was going to dump pop into the Chicago River like the Boston Tea Party and carbonate the Chicago River and actually use maybe Green River pop to make the Green River even more green. And it was kind of a joke, and I said I'm going to go there and have signs, and I said I'm going to start a new group called Soda Stop Our, gosh, I don't even remember, Stop Our Drinking Something. It was soda. I can't remember. It was a few months ago. But anyway, I made a big deal, kind of half joking, but also half serious about this was a wrong tax, and I implored the citizens of Cook County to rebel on this and not just take it. Because here we are once again with a tax that was clearly nothing more than a revenue generator. And yet it was being passed off like they were doing some kind of public good. And it would have been, and here's the thing. And so it passed, and sure enough, people were going to DuPage County and Lake County and other places. If you lived in Cook County, they were going over there to buy their pop. So it wasn't even generating the revenue. And people were upset the way this tax was unfolded and just kind of implemented without much discussion from the people. And the Cook County board members, commissioners, as well as the president, just figured, well, we'll just tax them more, just throw the taxes on it. And, you know, here's the thing. Tony Preckwinkle should have learned a lesson, like most politicians should have learned a lesson last year when Donald Trump became president. You can support Trump or not. I'm not going to get on that topic. But if there's a lesson to be learned from Donald Trump's winning, it was that people were getting tired of the status quo. They felt like they were being taken advantage of. The middle class felt like, I'm just getting taxed and taxed and taxed, and I'm not seeing anything of it. And the same problems are still existing. We had a $20 trillion deficit, but our schools weren't any better. Our highways weren't any better. We didn't get better services. I guarantee you, if we were $20 trillion in debt, but we had amazing school systems and amazing highways and amazing social services and amazing health care, people would say, you know what? Yeah, it's wrong to be $20 billion in debt. But you know what? We're getting something for that. That's what people were rebelling against in the last presidential election. We're $20 billion in debt, and we're no better off than we were 50 years ago. And the people in Cook County are saying, wait a minute, you just raised our property taxes and other taxes, and now you've got a $200 million hole in your budget, and you're coming back to me again. No, we're not taking this anymore. So it was actually a great great movement of democracy for the people to go to their representatives, the way our government's supposed to work, and say, enough is enough. And it still goes to show you here in Chicago that the name Daley still carries a lot of clout because Richard J. Daley, the former mayor's brother, is one of the commissioners on the Cook County Board. And it wasn't until John Daley decided to vote to repeal that soda tax, and then the dominoes fell, and all the other commissioners fell right in line. So you could say whatever you want about the Daleys, but they still kind of run this city and this county. But I was so happy to see that instead of just laying down and taking it, the electorate and the average person said, no, not this time. We're not taking this anymore. And I'm very surprised that Tony Preckwinkle did not learn the lesson of the last presidential election. You can't just keep going to the trough. The people are tired of that. And they showed that by electing Donald Trump. That was the message. And 4 months later, she acted as if it was business as usual. And she's going to pay the price. I said, if that tax had stayed in, if someone's going to run against her, the first thing that I would do if I was running against Tony Preckwinkle and that tax was still in, I would have my first press conference announcing my candidacy with a bunch of soda pop cans right on the podium with me to remind everyone of what she did with that pop tax. And so the funny thing is, now we all know how corrupt Chicago, Cook County, and Illinois politics have been, certainly in my entire lifetime. You cannot tell me, I do not believe that they cannot find $200 million of waste that they cannot cut out of their budget. Instead of tightening their budget and actually running government the way that we all as private citizens are expected to have a balanced checkbook and to only spend the money that we have, government has to learn to start doing that. And the people are saying that right now. And who knows if that kind of anger will last, but it's present right now. And so rather than tightening belts and rather than trying to clean house and getting rid of waste and getting rid of corruption, they just said, we're just going to find this, you know, here, oh, this tax worked in Philadelphia and it worked somewhere else, and we'll just throw it in. The other side of the coin is it was poorly presented. I used to work in public relations for about 10 years, and I've dealt with these kind of issues. And the most important thing is be honest with the public. Even if it's bad news, be honest. Because if you're not honest, it's going to come back to bite you in the butt. And that's what happened to Tony Preckwinkle. Not only did she impose this tax, but she pretended it was for health reasons, which was clearly not the case. And then she got greedy. She made it a dollar or a penny an ounce. You may think that that's not a lot of money, but as I said, 16-ounce bottle of pop, 16 extra cents. A six-pack? What about a 24-pack of pop? That added some real money when people went to the checkout line. That was real money. That wasn't just some little penny here, penny there. These were real these were extra dollars being added on, coming out of the weekly paycheck of people for something that they did buy every week, and they felt it, and they didn't like it. So maybe what Tony Preckwinkle should have done was maybe impose a half-cent tax initially and let people get used to it and say, we need this because we have this hole, and admit the fact that there's this hole, and maybe mention it could help perhaps a byproduct of this tax is maybe some people will actually stop drinking as much pop. But don't act like it was the main goal of this tax. And then to compound problems, if anybody's lived in Chicago for any period of time, and I've lived there my whole life, everybody knows that Chicago, for the most part, is like the biggest little city on earth. And Chicago likes its own and doesn't like outsiders. And really, Chicago does not like New York. We just have a huge chip on our shoulder about New York for whatever the reasons are. And so, what did Tony Preckwinkle do to try to win favor with the people and have them look at this tax a different way? She calls Mike Bloomberg, the three-time former mayor of New York and billionaire, to bring in his money and his $5 million commercial campaign to promote the health benefits of this tax. Okay, bad idea. Nobody, I can't believe that no one in Tony Preckwinkle's inner circle, when they sat in a thing and they sat in a meeting, nobody either had the guts or the intellect to raise their hand and say, you know, this is a bad idea, don't you? And they would say, well, why is it a bad idea? Someone wants to spend $5 million. It won't cost us anything on our behalf to educate the people. And the first thing the person had to say is, Chicagoans and Cook County people don't want to be told what to do. That's A. B, they don't want to be told what to do by an outsider. And C, they don't want to be told by an outsider from New York. That was doomed to fail with the first commercial. And maybe the commercial's content were valid, but once again, the perception. Adults don't want to be told what to do by the government. Chicagoans don't want to be told what to do by an outsider, and they certainly don't want to be told what to do by an outsider from New York. Doomed to fail, and fail it did. When she rolled out this program, Tony Preckwinkle did not think it out. As I said, be honest. Maybe start slow with a half cent so it's not as much as a sting in people's wallets. Don't forget, Tony Preckwinkle ran as the Cook to win the Cook County Board presidency against Todd Stroger, who certainly, as I've said many times, nice guy, but completely unqualified for that job. It was complete nepotism. His father was the board president, and he became board president. He wasn't qualified. It was pure nepotism. He never should have been in there. And one of the things he did was raise the Cook County sales tax to 10%, which drew huge criticism. Tony Preckwinkle ran against Todd Stroger and ran against that increase. And then soon after she became president and won on that platform, about a year later, she returned. She after bringing the tax down, she brought it back up to 10. Oops. So she's already was in trouble with the taxpayers who had a memory. And then she doubled down on this, and a huge, huge mistake. And it didn't need to be a mistake if it was better thought out from a political standpoint and from a public standpoint as well as a governmental standpoint. Because the problem with that tax was, if you would have tried to sell that tax and say, we're gonna add a penny on this, but here's the thing. You're going to get new services for this. You're going to see and feel the impact of that. That wasn't going to happen. All that was to fill a gap with bad management and overspending. So that was money that people were just paying because the government didn't know how to run its business. And that's not what people are into right now. Here's the irony. If you remember, Tony Preckwinkle was threatening doomsday. If we don't keep this, if we don't implement this tax, B, if we don't keep this tax, people are going to lose jobs, people are going to lose services. The whole government was going to collapse, it seemed, if we didn't charge a penny per ounce on pop. When did this happen all of a sudden, that pop was the only way to keep our government afloat? That was the message that was coming from Tony Preckwinkle, this doomsday scenario. Now that it's been repealed, one of the commissioners, Maria Pappas, says, I have no problems cutting 10 to 12% of my budget out. And if all the other people do that, we've got the $200 million. Wow. Imagine that. You can find waste. You can find overspending. You could find mismanagement. Maybe you can even find some corruption in your budgets. Yeah, I think you can. So instead of just doing business as usual and slapping a tax on the average person who just wants to get a nice bottle of pop, That's the easy way to do it, because it's harder to go in and have to make budget cuts and actually have to, not just spend wildly the public's money. The public is tired of providing money for governments and they're not using it right. We will be happy to pay taxes if we believe that they're going for something. Roads, social programs. If we see those working for people, we're the most generous country on earth. But when we see continually years and decades of waste, that's when we say no. And we said no, at least this country did overall, last November when they elected Donald Trump. And don't forget, it was Midwestern states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania which tipped that election to Donald Trump. Well, we're here in Illinois. We're in the heart of the Midwest. And even though Illinois voted for Hillary Clinton, and of course they would because Hillary Clinton was born in Illinois. She was a favorite son, so she was going to win the state. But the fact of the matter is the mindset about the country wanting to get more for their bang for their buck and that kind of revolt is still a Midwest kind of sentiment. So you should not have looked past that. We're in Illinois. We're already bankrupt. The people in Illinois are tired of paying taxes for politicians who have not run this state very well. And so Tony Preckwinkle doomed this from the beginning. And so if you go back to a podcast of mine from around April or May, you will certainly hear me talk about how my Spreckers, how I was jonesing for Spreckers, and now suddenly this tax was on, and I explained all of what I just said before. And here we are in October, not even a year later, several months later, and the people actually rebelled quicker than I thought they ever would. But I called for that kind of rebellion, and I hoped that it would happen, and sure enough it did. And you will see that that tomorrow the Cook County government will not fall apart, as Tony Preckwinkle had predicted, and that they will make the cuts needed. And hopefully they will learn a valuable lesson. You can't keep taking the people for granted. Because that's what happened here. This was a tax that maybe could have gone through and maybe could have helped, but it was handled and presented and implemented in a heavy-handed, business-as-usual, screw the people. We've gone to the trough. We'll go back to the trough again. And they were saying, no, you're not. And people really rebelled. They rebelled with their pocketbooks by going to other counties and buying their pop. Or they actually did something that actually should make us all feel happy as American citizens. They practiced democracy. They called their representatives, and they got in touch with them, and whether it was emails or phone calls, or whatever, and they said, we don't like this. And those guys and women realized that the people were serious and that maybe their jobs and as elected officials were on the line with an election coming up. And so the power of the people really did prevail here on a tax that was either unnecessary or sold in a very... a sinister way to shield it by talking about kids. There was a quote by somebody let me find this here, because it was actually, I feel sorry, Alyssa Bessler, who is the Illinois Public Health Institute. This was her quote when the tax was repealed. It looks like diabetes is the winner here today. I understand what she's saying, and she's using hyperbole, but sorry, that's not who won today. Who won today was actually democracy. It was actually the people against a tax that was poorly planned, poorly implemented, poorly explained to the people, and it's going away, and the people did stand up. So, whether I had anything to do with it or not, All I know is I can now, in fact, my stash of Spreckers that has been lined on my basement stairs actually has been running out, and I haven't bought any. I've been conserving it because I had a feeling that this was going to happen. And so now I will go back and buy my Spreckers on December 1st when the repeal takes place, and all will be well in the world. You got that little music there, Jasmine?
Sure do.
Hit it. And welcome back. So back to the segment here that I like to call You Heard It Here First. Very quickly. What an interesting turn of events has happened. And about a year ago, right around now, is when it first started. Former, we have to say now, NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick decided when he was still on the 49ers last year not to stand for the national anthem. And it was his way of protesting social injustice and protesting, certainly over the last couple of years, especially the conflict between the African-American community in general, in some areas, and the police. And it was this overall kind of social injustice and race relations and the way that people were being treated by the police. I have no problems with his protest in terms of what he was trying to do, the issue. It's certainly an important issue, and it's one that should be confronted, and it's one that should be brought to the forefront. But back when it happened about a year ago, my problem was that what Colin Kaepernick chose to do. Once again, as I just mentioned about Tony Preckwinkle, it wasn't well thought out. He brought in not standing for the national anthem, which meant then dotted line to the flag, which brought in a whole other issue, and it clouded the issue that Colin Kaepernick was really worried about, which was the social injustice that was going on. But by bringing in the flag and all that it means, and it has many meanings to many different people, he clouded the issue right from the beginning. There could have been another thing if he was so passionate about this issue, and I believe he is. I believe he's sincere about it. But he chose the wrong venue. He chose the wrong symbol. And he chose the wrong message, or not so much the message. He chose the wrong symbol for his message. And so by taking a knee during the national anthem, he was, in many people's eyes, showing disrespect for the country and for the flag. And so now you've got current soldiers, you've got veterans who have fought in different wars, you've got patriotic people who look at that flag as meaning something, and you've brought them into the discussion where that wasn't the discussion. Patriotism wasn't necessarily the discussion. The discussion here was relations and fairness and social justice, all important things. Don't bring the flag into it. I'm not sure, once again, I'm not sure who was advising him, but it wasn't the right symbol, and it immediately muddied up his message. And the irony is that he did that, and I even said, and not only that, but he was kind of the wrong messenger for this as well. Because if you know Colin Kaepernick's story, he was raised by white parents. He was adopted, I believe he's adopted or foster child. And he was raised by white parents, and he wound up getting advantages and going into college and then becoming a major, a Super Bowl, not winner, but a Super Bowl quarterback. And while he was talking about the injustices that were going on he was an example of someone that got breaks. So he wasn't even really a good spokesman. So many times the messenger has to meet the message. So there was a conflict there, but regardless, that's what he wanted to do. And as I said, you have to respect his right to do that. But either it was his idea or those who were advising him, and maybe they wanted to make a big splash. Maybe they wanted to make some real kind of newsworthy effort. And they did that, but it was wrong. It was not the right way to get something done. And then, once again, having worked in public relations, I've dealt with charities or kind of protests and things like that. What you want to be able to do, if you're going to make a stand and you want to affect change, you start out by having a definitive goal. There might be an overarching goal. We all want unity and peace on earth. But that's been an elusive goal since the beginning of time. But we have been able to do smaller things that lead to that goal, that make that goal perhaps closer to a reality than it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 500 years ago. We have made progress. Might not be as much as we want. It might not be as fast as we want, but we certainly have made progress because we focus on a specific issue and tackle that one. And hopefully it's in the road leading to the umbrella issue that we want. So Colin Kaepernick, if he wanted to take a knee and said, I'm not going to stand up for the national anthem until this problem is solved, then pick a problem that actually could be solved in a relatively short time with some attention to it that does lead to your larger overarching message. But if you remember, he said, I want all social justice in the world to be cured or in the country. It was a pie in the sky great from an optimism standpoint, from a reality standpoint. There's no chance. He was never going to stand up again. If that was his proviso, if that was his caveat, I will not stand up until there is social justice in this country, then it was clear from his standpoint he was never going to stand up for the national anthem again because that's not going to be cured in one season. But if he would have said, I'm going to take a knee until the government or cities in some very affected cities create new committees or new standards for police or new community outreach programs, those are within reach. Then his protest would have meant something. It would have begun to get the ball rolling. And then the fact that he could have stood up for the national anthem would have actually shown progress was being made. But here we are a year later after he said it and people are still taking a knee. They don't even know why they're taking a knee anymore. And then President Trump, for some reason, gets involved in it. And don't forget, this has been going on from last season. But during a presidential campaign, Trump didn't pay attention. Now, for some reason, he started tweeting about it. And then it became this national debate. And now we've got some teams doing it, some teams holding hands. And at the end of the day, the sad part is his original goal, his original message for social injustice has been completely forgotten. Now his taking a knee is all about patriotism. That wasn't his message. But that's what it's taken on. And I said this at the beginning, Colin, what are you doing? I appreciate and respect your sentiment and your passion for affecting change. But if you're going to use your celebrity and use whatever power, make sure you use it in the correct way. And make sure you can actually affect some change. And perhaps that change that you could affect then affects more change. And so at least the ball is rolling forward. Because right now, the ball that he decided to put into the national debate, that ball is still sitting there. It's still on the goal line. It's not any closer than it was moving, to use a football analogy. The ball hasn't changed one bit. And there's people that are taking a knee, but it's not about what his issue was. His issue was social injustice. His issue was the relations between African-American communities and the police. That was the issue. Have you been hearing about anyone talking about that in the last several months since Trump started to tweet about this? It's all been about patriotism and the flag. That wasn't his issue. And I predicted he would be out of a job. He did this while he was a free agent or going to be a free agent. There are major sponsors. The NFL is a billion-dollar business. I said, be careful, Colin, because you're going to make yourself a rabble-rouser and teams are not going to want to touch you. The guy's a talented football player. He went to the Super Bowl a few years ago. He doesn't have a job now. He's a hot potato. He's a rabble-rouser. No one wants to hire him. He's tried to backtrack. He's given a lot of money to charity. You made your mistake. You can't take it back now. And that's what I'm saying is before you go out into the public arena, your passion is important. There's no question about that. But you have to sit down and you have to look five steps ahead and say, what are the possible landmines here? And what are the possible problems and what's a good way to get around those problems? If he would have done that, he probably would have a job today. And there may have been some progress. And his taking a knee during the national anthem or whatever he would have decided to do actually may have helped affect some change. But a year later, his personal situation is worse than it was. He doesn't have a job. And the issue and the cause that he was so interested and passionate about hasn't been corrected, and very little has been done on it. And whatever his outward sign was, the taking of the knee during the national anthem, it just brought up a whole other issue. His issue is on the back burner or completely ignored. So I'm not sure what he accomplished here. His issue and his cause hasn't moved forward, and he's out of a job. And there's a whole other firestorm going on about patriotism and the flag and being American, and that wasn't what he was talking about. So, these issues, whether it was the pop tax in Cook County or Colin Kaepernick's protest, I'm a part of me. I was able to sort of see through the problems there, but I'm actually disappointed that I was right. Because Colin Kaepernick's initial issue is important. And having a Cook County board and Cook County government run well is important. And perhaps raising money to help put gaps in and start new programs is important. Implementation is so key, folks. Implementation. How you're going to do this. How you're going to make sure that what you really want to do gets done. And it deals with being honest with people. It deals with some planning on your part to best communicate what you want to communicate to people and how you want to help and how you want to affect change positively. But you have to sit down and think about it and think about all the potential problems before you go out there. Because once you go out there and it's doomed. And so pop tax repealed, Colin Kaepernick out of a job, and his issue not getting any attention. You heard it here first. And as I said, I'm actually kind of sad that I was right. But if you listen to this podcast, you will hear this stuff first, so I hope you will continue to listen and hear what's going to happen before it happens. Little music there, Jasmine. And now we're going to get a little lighter. Wow. Sort of like Mr. Politics there. But, you know, there's things that happen in the world that actually are kind of important, so sometimes you just have to have a little fun. So, Jasmine, my new producer, I don't. You probably never listened to the podcast. So are you already going, what the hell is this guy talking about?
No, I didn't say that yet.
Oh, yo-ho! Ho-ho! Hi-yo! I predicted she wouldn't last 3 weeks. I don't think she's going to be back next week.
No, I love it. I love it so far, seriously.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much. Yeah, we'll see. Well, don't forget, I also give her $10 out of my pocket just to make sure she comes back.
Shh, management might be listening.
And I want to welcome Emily Armonetti to the show. Hello, Emily.
Hey.
And we are here in the Pop Culture, Pop Culture Club. I have a new producer, Jasmine, who, just so you know, Emily, she can speak in my ear, you know, to let me know, like, when I'm on time and things like that. And so, just so you know, Jasmine, Jasmine said to me about a minute ago, Penelope's on the line. So you are now Penelope.
I actually like that name.
Oh, wait, Jasmine.
Maybe I could rebrand.
Oh, wait, wait, Jasmine, are you saying that you did not say Penelope or that you had a cold?
No, Penelope is the code.
Oh, that's a code. Okay. So you have a code name now.
Yes, Penelope.
I like that, too. I like the idea of having a code name.
I used to work with somebody. And when I was a magazine editor, and so there we did the story on the actress from the 90s and 80s, Penelope Ann Miller. Remember her?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course.
So, you know, we had this big story, and so my boss, the publisher, is looking over the galleys of the story, and he said, so who's this Penelope Ann Miller?
Oh,
and so now,
oh, no.
Do I laugh right in my boss's face?
Right.
So then I just subtly said, well, you know, Penelope Ann Miller, and I tried to, you know, say it. You know,
right. Move it over. Yeah, just move it over.
Yeah, you know, Penelope Ann Miller is in a new movie with Michael Broderick and Marlon Brando. But I'm like, oh, my God, Penelope. I mean, that was probably 25 years ago. I'll never forget Penelope Ann Miller. And so now, Penelope Armonelli, Armonetti.
Wow, this code name is taking on a whole life of its own.
There's Emily Armonetti, and then there's Penelope Armoletti.
Yes.
Okay.
It's like that could be my alter ego.
So what we want to talk about today in the Pop Culture Club. Do you have that music there, Jasmine? There she goes. Just so we officially, you know, it's not the Pop Culture Club segment until we hear the Pop Culture Club or the Culture Club song. And just once again, for Jasmine's information, do you understand why I'm playing that song in the background? Turn the music down so you could talk because you're on the same microphone.
No idea.
You have no idea?
No idea.
Okay, turn the music down yourself. You can get rid of the music. Okay, just so you know, just as indoctrinate you, this segment's called the Pop Culture Club, right?
Right.
Because there's pop culture.
Right.
And then it's the Culture Club because it's like a club with me and Emily. Like we're in a club talking about things. The song is by Culture Club.
Get out.
Karma Chameleon is by Culture Club.
The more you know every day.
So this show works on many layers, and you will get used to that. So that's why it's the Pop Culture Club, and I play Culture Club underneath it because it's pop culture. There's the topic, and then the Culture Club is the song.
Oh, Jim, you're so much smarter than you look.
Oh, wow. Holy smokes.
Oh, my God.
I was worried about making my boss look like an idiot when I said Penelope Ann Miller. And I'm not her boss by any means, but wow. Holy smokes. I'm liking Jasmine. She is not afraid.
A little bit of a firecracker.
Firecracker? How about an M80? You're not a firecracker. You're an M80.
Oh, my God.
You're a cherry bomb.
That sounds really good. It's a really good drink, too.
And a good song by John Mellencamp. So, what I want to talk about in the Pop Culture Club with Emily, talk about how your life can change in a week.
Right.
And I'm talking about, well, why don't you say what we're going to talk about today?
Oh, well, there's this bombshell New York Times report about Harvey Weinstein, who is like a Hollywood titan, alleging that a number of actresses over time, including Ashley Judd and Rose McGowan, had been paid settlements over sexual harassment accusations over decades. But then on the heels of this, like within a week of the New York Times piece, Ronan Farrow, Mia Farrow's son, wrote a piece for The New Yorker in which he chronicled not only stories of women who had allegedly been sexually harassed by Harvey Weinstein, but in a few cases, assaulted by him. So this has become a house of cards because from the time that the New York Times article was published until now, which has been, what, like 10 days?
Yeah.
This guy's entire career and life has fallen apart.
For people that don't know, Harvey Weinstein, is it Weinstein or Weinstein? Weinstein.
Weinstein.
Yeah.
Weinstein.
Harvey Weinstein. He has been around in the movie business for, as Emily correctly says, a titan. He is a Hollywood mogul in every sense of the word. He started the movie production studio Miramax with his brother, and then it was bought out by Disney, I believe, and and then it became the Weinstein Company, and they were responsible for, over the last 25 or 30 years, some amazing movies and TV shows and magazines. I mean, Oscar winners like Shakespeare in Love and The Artist and Pulp Fiction and Good Will Hunting. I mean, their track record, Miramax and the Weinstein Company, has become legendary. And this guy, through that, has become a hugely popular and powerful guy in Hollywood, to the point where if you ever watch a Hollywood award show, people will just call him Harvey.
Yeah.
I mean, how many producers in Hollywood does anybody know their names? You know directors. You know Martin Scorsese, or you know Quentin Tarantino or Spike Lee, or you know people, you know, some of these well-known guys by the directors by names, but nobody knows producers. And so people knew who Harvey Weinstein was, to the point where he was even just known as Harvey in the industry. And you would hear people at the award shows thanking Harvey, and everybody knew who he was talking about. So this guy was immensely powerful, and everybody knew him, and everybody, well, I don't know if they liked him, but they respected him, and they had to, because he pulled the strings. Producers are the people who hired the actors and actresses, who hire the directors, who put the money together for these movies. Their careers depended in many ways on being on Harvey Weinstein's good side. And what's amazing now that you find this out is that there's been a lot of hypocrisy in Hollywood on this one, which is really interesting. That's the side part of this story, too.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, again, like every day there's a new report. And, you know, following the first couple of articles that came out, now you've got, you know, additional actresses who are not kind of included in these initial reports. Actresses like A-list actresses like Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie are coming out.
Mira Sorvino.
And, you know, they've got similar. So Mira Sorvino. I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow and Mira Sorvino, their careers were basically launched by Harvey Weinstein. They both won Oscars on the back of their collaborations with him, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then you've got, you know, some real like heavy hitters in Hollywood coming out and saying, actually, you know what, when I was first starting out, he did the same thing to me. You've got everyone coming out, everyone from, you know, Judi Dench to Leonardo DiCaprio to Obama, now having made statements publicly denouncing this behavior in the wake of the news. A lot of the reporting is suggesting that this was actually just kind of an open secret in Hollywood, and that people have known about this for decades.
Yeah, in fact, I saw a report that there's a report now. The New York Times broke this story, and I saw a report that there's a former New York Times reporter who had this story in 2004.
Yeah,
and then he got wind of it. And he went to the New York Times and sort of said, you might want to kill this story. So actually the media has its own implications in keeping this information down, because Harvey Weinstein was very influential with advertising. His movies.
He was very influential with advertising, but he was also influential in the sense that, you know, he had a powerful legal team. And first of all, it was hard to get people to talk about it anyway, because the people who worked for him, who allegedly knew about this, they signed these NDAs, and, you know, they were afraid that, you know, they could be, there were legal implications to doing things like going to the media or going public with this stuff. But then also, you know, if a publication wanted to come out with something and it wasn't airtight, I mean, he's got a legal team waiting to pounce on them too. So I think that also helped him keep this buried.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. Like I said, the guy was powerful. He had the ability to keep this buried. When you find out about these people, and namely these guys that partake in sexual harassment or sexual intimidation, who have the power to exert over women, and in some cases even men, from a sexual standpoint, this is not something that they just learned or just did recently. It does usually go way back. Initially, Harvey Weinstein's admitted to some extent, but then used the feeble excuse of, well, that was the culture I was raised in.
Right.
Okay, well, you know what? That doesn't cut it, because, you know, there was a time when, you know, cavemen killed people, and then we don't kill them anymore.
Right.
I mean, there have been some things that we have done that have been, you know, accepted that were suddenly not accepted either culturally or by the law. And so we had to change our behavior. And clearly he did not have to change his behavior, because it was being either accepted or hidden for him. And so that didn't turn out to be a very good explanation.
No, I mean, and this also, either way, it's not enough to say, oh, you know, when I was coming up, the rules were different, and the rules are just so confusing these days. It's like, no, they're not. You know, Harvey Weinstein didn't get to where he was by being a dummy. You know, I mean, I think you kind of have an understanding of what's acceptable and what's not. The thing is, I think, you know, he seems to be one of, you know, I mean, there are a number of people out there like this, you know, someone who gets to a point where they have a sense of entitlement. They feel they're untouchable, you know. And so I think in those cases, they know what they're doing is wrong. They just don't think anyone can ever
touch
do
them. Yeah,
ever.
Well, you know, and one, yeah. And as I've said many times, and it's, I'm just pointing it out. I'm not, you know, condemning it or whatever. We are certainly in an era right now of female empowerment. And so it's no surprise that in the last 6 months, think about it, in the last 6 months, three major powerful people, men, have gone down in flames because of sexual harassment, and they all fit the bill that you just now, Emily, that you exactly described as these powerful people that knew the rules, knew what they were doing was wrong, and still did them.
Yeah,
you had Roger Ailes of Fox News, who you put together and invented Fox News, who had to be fired because of his sexual harassment to many of the anchor women on Fox News. Then, three or 4 months ago, Bill O'Reilly, who was brought down also by the New York Times for his sexual harassment, number one show, a cable news show, brought down in flames. And now here's Harvey Weinstein, one of the most powerful, to use a Yiddish term, machers in Hollywood. And I mean, not even that. His wife now announced that she's leaving him.
Oh, I mean,
so he's lost.
I mean, not only that. I mean, look, you know, everyone is coming out and publicly denouncing this. He's been ousted from his own company. His wife has announced she's leaving him. He's now said he's going into a residential treatment facility. And I don't know if you saw this, because this was just reported today. But today, the Hollywood Reporter is saying that the Academy Motion Picture of Arts and Sciences has said that they are calling an emergency Board of Governors meeting to address this.
Really?
So, yes.
Wow. What do you think? You think they might take his Oscars away?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they could kick him out of the Academy. I mean, it depends on what their, you know, bylaws are. But, I mean, I would think they could potentially take his Oscars away. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that's ever been done before. I know some guy was kicked out of the Academy for, like, illegally, like, distributing the screeners, I think it was.
Right.
I remember that from, like, a few years back. But this is the thing. They're getting together because they're realizing this is a very powerful member of their Academy. And so now they're calling this emergency meeting. And it's really just become, like I said, a house of cards. I mean, it all seems to just become.
And here's the other hypocrisy. The hypocrisy of it is, as you said earlier, not only was did his behavior seem to be an open secret, if that's a phrase, in Hollywood, that everybody knew about it, everybody whispered about it.
Maybe people joked about it, but nobody talked about it.
Mm-hmm. And let's not forget, Hollywood is a business that is founded on gossip. And so there's no way that this was not known, especially with someone of his profile. And when you look at the people that were involved in it, as you said, A-list actresses in many cases, in some cases like, you know, Oscar winners like, Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie and Mira Sorvino. But who could even count the other women who never made it and who are on his casting couch? But,
oh, right. Well, this is the thing about stuff like this. You know, he's targeting women who are just getting their careers off the ground. And even in the case of, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie, you know, they're saying that he did this to them when they were first getting started, you know.
And even Brad Pitt.
In a vulnerable position.
And Brad Pitt was going out with Gwyneth Paltrow at the time, and he apparently confronted Harvey Weinstein about this because Gwyneth Paltrow told Brad Pitt what Harvey Weinstein did. Basically, you know, he would invite these women up to a hotel room and say it was going to be a meeting about a script or a meeting about a part, and he'd come out with a robe, or sometimes he would be naked, and he would be in a bathtub, and he would want them to give him a massage. I mean, you know, this is right out of like the movies that, you know, the sleazy producer. And all I can say is, the other side, from a funny, you know, kind of byproduct of this, if they do make the Harvey Weinstein movie, you know, like on, you know, like if Ryan Murphy or somebody now.
Right. I was going to say, it's going to be like one of the next American crime stories.
Yeah, instead of like the O.J. Simpson thing or the feud, you know, with Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, all I can say is, Jeff Garlin from the Goldbergs and Curb Your Enthusiasm, he is the he is the perfect guy to play Harvey Weinstein. So if anybody's hoping for a Harvey Weinstein movie, it's Jeff Garlin. Take a look.
I know, right?
Go online, pick Jeff Garlin's picture out.
Google
Jeff Garlin if you don't know who I'm talking about, and then Google Harvey Weinstein and tell me that Jeff Garlin is not the best guy to play that role. But the hypocrisy of this, too, is, and that's why I said, Hollywood has to also take a step back, because now they're all jumping on and they're all denouncing. And I understand that, but they also help keep this secret. And they also, don't forget, they also took his money, because Harvey Weinstein was at every, you know, political and every gala for different charities. He was at Gloria Steinem. You know, feminist and female equality things, and people had to have known this, but Harvey Weinstein, brought in money and brought in people to donate money, and so people once again were, for the sake of their cause, even though they knew his reputation was in complete opposite of what they were trying to do, they also needed him for his power and his clout and his money.
Yeah, I mean, I think he also, you know, projected this image of, you know, a very liberal person, a champion of women.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago. His company distributed The Hunting Ground. I don't know if you remember that, but that was a documentary just within the last couple of years that was, you know, trying to raise awareness and bring attention to campus sexual assault, which has become a big issue, that for a long time people tried to sweep under the carpet, and women really couldn't get, you know, they couldn't get their stories heard or believed. And so here's a guy who, on one hand, is projecting this image of being this kind of champion of women's causes. And as you said, you know, he was a big champion of Gloria Steinem. He donated a lot of money, or raised a lot of money, for Hillary Clinton. You know, I mean, he marched when Park City did their kind of women's march.
Right. That's what I mean.
During the Sundance Film Festival, he was right there marching.
Yeah. So,
you know,
so
there, it's a weird.
Well, because like I said, you know, Hollywood is, you know, the sad part is that when you, and a lot of people then, you know, and the same thing happened with Bill Cosby, when people saying, well, why would women keep this a secret? Why didn't they come, if this has been going on for 20 or 30 years, perhaps, in both cases, with Bill Cosby as well as Harvey Weinstein, you know, why wouldn't women come forward? Part of it is the embarrassment of it. Part of it is their denial. They don't want to confront it. They're afraid of the stigma. And sadly, in Hollywood, you know, don't forget who we're dealing with. We're dealing with actresses who want a career, and they know.
Right.
And Ashley Judd, you know, is basically said, because I rebuked him, my career, which was on a very, you know, a high trajectory, suddenly stalled when all of a sudden I rebuked his advances. And so, sadly,
and not only that, but Rose McGowan, who was also one of the women who the New York Times reported on, she's been talking for years about the treatment that women get in Hollywood. Not just that she, you know, not specifically about Harvey Weinstein, but about this whole casting couch, you know, issue. And even also, she's been talking about, like, just women having equality in Hollywood and in the world in general. And, I mean, her career, those two have been sidelined for years.
Right.
And now you look back and you think, well, no wonder why, you know? I mean, what women were afraid of actually did.
Exactly.
To these two, because they both had very promising careers that really kind of fizzled very quickly, you know?
That's my point.
And then, you know, I also think this thing about why didn't women talk? I mean, that's part of a bigger issue in our culture, which is victim blaming, you know, and it's really kind of ridiculous, because you're basically asking these women to defend the institutions that allowed this to happen to them and allowed this to happen to them without anybody helping them or doing anything about it or believing them, you know. So it's kind of, you know, I mean, it's certainly a big part of the commentary right now, but it's disappointing that the story even goes there, you know.
Yeah.
And it also takes the focus off of him and what he's done.
Oh, certainly,
He's the one who's, you know, so.
Well, here's the best part, too. So, you know, Harvey was in business with his brother, Robert. And so, and he's on the board. And initially, you know, Robert was trying to see if his brother could outlast this storm, but it was quickly spiraling downward. And so then within several days, the board of Weinstein Company, with his brother included, voted to fire him. And so this goes to show you, you know, you said that he was going to go for help, and, you know, Harvey Weinstein was going for help and go for treatment. He's clearly in major denial, because he's saying that his brother betrayed him.
Yeah.
Now, so he's overlooking his behavior that's been going on for 30 years, and now he's blaming his brother for not sticking by him, when it's like, hey, you're the guy that put us in this situation. You're the guy that did this this abhorrent behavior, and now you're blaming me that I had to fire you? So,
yeah.
This story will continue to unravel. And you mentioned something that's really interesting, too, just a little sideline of it. So here's, you know, Ronan Farrow, Mia Farrow's son, and Woody Allen's son, who winds up breaking part of this story as well. It initially appeared in the New York Times, but then Ronan Farrow, who is a journalist, worked for MSNBC for a while as well, winds up, you know, he's sort of, think about it, I mean, he's kind of Hollywood royalty, and he's actually, you know, uncovering the dirty side of Hollywood. So that's a little interesting, you know, sidelight on it as well. And I can only imagine as time goes on, you're going to start to hear more about this, but it really does come down to the fact of, think of just how fast, within 2 weeks, this guy's career, which was, you know, one of the most celebrated and envied in Hollywood, as well as his personal life. He was, you know, the bon vivant of Hollywood. And within a couple of weeks, he is now a pariah. And he is lost his wife, his family, with his, I mean, obviously with his brother now, estranged at the very least, as well as his career and his prestige and everything else. Wow, what a difference 2 weeks make.
Yeah, and, you know, I have a feeling that this is not, I mean, I don't think it's the last we'll hear of his story, but I have a feeling that this will, and I hope it does actually, open the floodgates to anyone in that industry or any other industry who has been perpetrating the same type of behavior, and people were too afraid to talk about it. So, I mean, perhaps this will be, you know, a step forward in terms of, you know, anyone who's either been harassed or assaulted, to feel like they can actually come forward and then to feel like they can talk about it without repercussion. So we'll have to see.
And even from the standpoint of Bill O'Reilly, who, you know, was railing that the New York Times, you know, is just this liberal newspaper out to get all conservatives and destroy all conservatives of any power or any kind of, media or, business influence. That the New York Times is just out to get the conservative side. Well, the New York Times, broke this story on, as you said earlier, perhaps one of the most celebrated liberals in the country, if not certainly in Hollywood. So they're not picking sides here. You know, Bill O'Reilly was done in by this same issue by the New York Times, conservative, but so was Harvey Weinstein. So they're not, and they may have in the past decided to cover it up, but they certainly didn't now. So he really can't use that card either in his demise. And it has really been a fascinating story on many counts, and I'm sure it's not done. But wow, as I said, what a difference a couple of weeks makes. And once again, I said this earlier in the show about being honest, and Emily and I both work together in public relations. At the end of the day, what I've always tried to advise people was tell the truth. And you know what? Harvey Weinstein could have got ahead of this story by coming forward before the story broke years ago and getting help and saying, look, I've been doing this, but he clearly is still in denial. But, you know, if you've got these, everybody's got skeletons in their closet, I understand that. But when you're in the public eye, the sooner you can be within yourself to admit your failures and publicly say that we are a very forgiving country if people will admit their failures. And I think, once again, this is the downfall of somebody of their own making. And so it's fascinating to see just how a very successful career and a successful and powerful person can spiral in today's world. It doesn't even take months anymore. It takes days.
Right.
So anyway, we'll see what happens with Harvey Weinstein. And I want to thank once again Penelope for... for joining us, and I also want to.
We need a code name for you. I guess you kind
of. Oh, there's another. Oh, believe me, there's a lot of code names out there for me. You can't say any of them on on the internet. They're too mean for that.
Yeah, you need the bleep button.
Yeah, definitely the dump button for those. But thank you again, Emily. In quotes, Penelope.
Thanks, Jim.
We'll talk to you next week. And Jasmine hit that music. And so, episode 74 comes to an end. I want to thank my new producer for the time being. We shall see. Jasmine Cooper. And I want to thank Penelope Emily Arminetti for joining me as well. This has been Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted on WGNPlus.com. It's the only podcast from the end of the web to your screen.